Today we have on Stephen Puri. He's a multipreneur, started various companies. He was in various senior leadership roles at companies like 20th Century Fox and DreamWorks. Most recently, he is the founder and CEO of the Suka Company, which was previously known as Centered.
The notion of the office has evolved a lot in the last 100 years. Think about a worker 100 years ago. Probably the office was the farm, and your boss was your dad, right? My buddy that I was doing Centered with was like, I don't know what to do here anymore. He had a beautiful daughter. And he's like, I want to go get a real job. He works at a real estate company. He's a fantastic engineer and a really good guy. And he's just like, I'm tapping out. I don't have religion for this anymore. I don't see this vision. That's when I was like, okay, I'll just buy the company. Like, he's a good guy and he wants to do good things in the world. He wants to have a child and all this stuff, right? So that's probably not the most interesting story for you, because the interesting stories are the ones where it's like, you don't get along. And I had one of those, because it was his idea. He was like, what about this? Da, da, da. He and I had never had the conversation about, what if this doesn't work? How do we want to wrap it up? And when it came time to go, this is not working, we need to wrap it up. That was a painful mistake on my part of not having gone into it, just like a chess game. I need to think through all the different chess moves, like several moves down. And that was one where I was like, dude, we gotta pay the tax.
Welcome to Funds and Founders. This weekly show is tailored for Austin founders navigating the early stages of their entrepreneurial journey. I'm your host and fellow Austinite, Abhinav Sinha. If you're looking for the motivation and the insight needed to build a successful company, you're in the right place. Today we have on Stephen Puri. He is a USC graduate. He's a multipreneur, started various companies, started his career out in film. He started and exited a CGI company called Centropolis FX. He was in various senior leadership roles at companies like 20th Century Fox and DreamWorks. He got back into tech and played various chief strategy roles at various different companies and startups. Most recently, he is the founder and CEO of the Suka Company, which was previously known as Centered, where he was the chief content officer. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
It's nice to be here.
Quick high point for you. I know recently you had one of your highest traffic days on the Suka Company.
This is true.
Do you want to briefly talk about that and what the Suka Company is doing?
Sure. Let me give you some context for this, which is what we believe is that like the notion of the office has evolved a lot in the last 100 years from, if you think about a worker 100 years ago, probably the office was the farm and your boss was your dad, right? Steam engine, industrial revolution, suddenly the office is a factory. And then you have to live close to the factory and you have to go in there. Right? Computer, the office is the office. And then the pandemic was a forcing function towards this, you know, hybrid remote world where suddenly the office is everywhere. I have the office here if I have my laptop. You know, I was in New York last week, SF right before. And what's interesting is if you think about the tool set that you had as a worker, when you went from the farm to the factory, you didn't like bring your rake and your hoe, you know what I mean? You got a screwdriver and a wrench.
Yeah.
Then when you went to the office, you didn't take the screwdriver and wrench with you. You got a new set of tools. But this last transition, the tool set really didn't adapt to the different challenges. It was just like, oh, well, you use email, email's everywhere. Well, you use this. And working hybrid or remote can be awesome. Flexibility, you know, you get kind of like set up your life the way you want it. And everyone wants to be productive. Everyone wants, I think, ultimately to do things with their life, right? And if you don't be in the workforce and don't take someone else's money. Just like figure out how you can be inspired. And what we did with the Suka Company is we said, okay, how do we adapt this concept of the office so that it works for this hybrid world? What are the things that you need now that you may be working from a coffee shop in Costa Rica? And, you know, the guy that is on your team is working out of a office in San Francisco, and then there's a girl in Chicago, you know, working at home. So that's what we do, is we make remote work work.
Sweet. How was it having one of your highest traffic days most recently?
It's super fun because when we launched this, it's kind of a novel idea. Now there are a lot of people pursuing this, realizing like the office needs to be reinvented. It's not like the old days, right? And getting that word out is, you know, always a challenge because you have so many different channels and you're being like a startup founder, a young startup, you're experimenting. You're like, oh, let's try paid ads. Oh, let's try search ads. Oh, let's try referral programs. Oh, let's try. You cycle through these things going like, where am I finding signal? And what is interesting for us is that we found signal recently with a lot of writers. which in some ways is obvious. Oh, writers need to be on their laptop in a flow state for a few hours to produce great writing.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, writers also, by nature of what they do, they communicate. So when they find something like, hey guys, I found a great thing. So that's helped us a lot recently as we built a community inside Sukha. You know, Sukha means happiness. It means self-fulfillment in Sanskrit. Yeah. It's that sense of like, oh, I'm doing something with my life. I feel happy. Like, this is what I'm meant to do. So it was great to have a high traffic day. I look forward to having even higher traffic days. But the notion that it's growing, it's great because for a long period of time, you're just kind of like pushing on walls.
Yeah.
Which wall has the door?
Nice. So on the show, I like talking about the journey. How did you reach where you did? Mm-hmm. What did you build? A question I like asking is, where do you think your entrepreneurial journey started? At what point? It could be very early on, very late. But what would you say was a defining moment of starting that journey?
Well, I'd say it was for me, because my parents both worked at IBM their entire careers practically. Like, very long, decades, right? Mom was a software engineer. Dad was a hardware engineer. And when I was at USC, I started working as a junior at this ad agency that did music videos and trailers for movies and commercials for movies and stuff like that. It's kind of a part-time gig, and I found it was fascinating. I loved, because I didn't have an experience. I didn't have a background being in film. My dad was not a writer of films. Yeah. And my mom was not a star. Like, it's kind of like, yeah, I've seen some films. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars. They were cool, right? And when the president of that company, you know, really became a mentor to me, I felt like, oh, this is interesting being part of a small company where you have a lot of agency. Obviously not in the advertising agency sense, but you have a lot of control. And like, you feel the result of your inputs immediately. I was 17 when I started working there and worked really hard. And that was my taste of like, oh, wow, you can be an entrepreneur. I looked at my boss, who was like probably 15 years older than I, and like experienced, and he'd been at ABC, at NBC before, blah, blah, blah. By the time I was 22, I owned the agency. He basically said, I want to go off to Paris and do my thing, blah, blah. And that was kind of cool. It'd be like, oh, wow. Like, the company's name is on the door. Like, I'm the CEO of that name, right? And that, I think, led me to a lot of this, you know, whether producing films, which each film was almost like a startup company, to the Sukha, which is like, I think this is actually something that'll help change the world.
Nice. Yeah. In that initial experience, what's one key takeaway you had? You mentioned autonomy. You mentioned understanding that that is an avenue, that is a path, a non-traditional path. What's one other thing that you take away from that experience?
I think probably the biggest takeaways are the things like the lessons you learn in a painful way rather than like, I did everything right. I didn't do everything right. And I think one of the biggest things I didn't do was after my mentor left and I took over those accounts, like the Warner Brothers account, the Orion accounts, like that, I didn't fill that gap with people smarter than I was. You know, I thought, oh my God, I know everything. I'm a 22-year-old superstar, blah, 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 right? And that was a huge mistake. You know, it's that old thing about the more you learn, the more you understand you don't know what you don't know. So that sense of like, be very respectful of what you don't know and try and find friends and allies that do know what you don't know, that was a big takeaway. But a takeaway because I learned it the hard way, not the easy way.
Yeah. How do you go from running that agency to starting the CGI company? Or was it the same company?
No, it's a different company. So what is interesting is in the course of doing, you know, these film trailers, essentially, met a lot of film people, which had not been part of my background.
Yeah.
And this was when film was going digital. It was stopping being photochemical. It was suddenly like, digitized everything. Kodak was like, we'll help you do that. That led me to meet a couple of people that were at the forefront of that. And it was that sense of like, oh, I love being around people who are smarter than I, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I could learn from you. You get better tennis by playing people who are better than you are, not worse.
Yeah.
And they were starting a digital effects company. I went there, started a very junior position, and basically learned my way up in the first year. And then that led to becoming a digital effects producer and went on to a film that won the Academy Award for the visual effects. Nice. So that was a great sort of career leap. And then off that, the director, producer, and I teamed up and said, we should start a company just to do computer generated effects.
Nice.
We should pull together all the people we like. We should, you know, fund it. So we raised like $15 million. I was probably 26 at the time and built it. I was employee number one, built it to 80 people and did a bunch of movies through there, and then ended up selling that. We got acquired by Das Werk, this nice. Big German, sort of Liberty Media of Germany. Nice.
Why the decision to sell? Oh, was it yours? Were you involved in that decision? And how does that come about?
I think I have a restlessness about me. Like, it was really fun learning how to do trailers, music videos, commercials. And then there's a moment where I was like, I don't want to wake up and be 30 years old and be like, just making like music video number 19 for Britney Spears. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, you learn everything you're going to learn for the first one or two. And then when I went to digital effects and doing trailer, you know, doing all these things, it's like, okay, you get to a point where you're like, okay, I don't want to wake up being like 30, 40 years old doing that. In the course of doing like 14 movies, the digital effects, I was very lucky. At that point, I'd done work with Jim Cameron, Mel Gibson, Roland Emmerich, Scorsese, like David Fincher, Woody Allen, Jim Jarmusch, like all these guys, including ones that don't typically do like digital effects movies, but their movies end up becoming digital. And that was when I was like, okay, I think what I want to do next is stop making like this little portion of someone's film, but actually help put together the entire film. And that's when I got on this track to be like a studio executive on that.
Nice. Based on the story, it seems like you just entered the film industry. It wasn't a targeted, catered decision of like, no, that's exactly what I wanted.
I fell ass backwards into it. You know, I'd like to tell you there's some great plan, but it's just kind of like, you know, you and I talking about doing something, going downstairs, there's a donut machine.
Yeah.
We sell some donuts tomorrow. We're like, we could sell more on Thursday. Yeah. Suddenly you have a donut business. You're like, wow, okay. It's more like that.
How was it being an executive at companies like 20th Century Fox, DreamWorks? Was it what you thought it would be? What did you learn out of it? And
the best part of it was, I love working with writers to break story, which means essentially sit around and really try to get inside. What does this character need? What do they want? What do they need? What are the events that force them to actually grow? Who are the people around them that help tell that story? That concept of like, here is this character journey and we're going to build this movie around it. That's super cool when you're working with a talented writer. It is just like an amazing process of doing that. And so I was very lucky that at DreamWorks, I worked with about a dozen of the top writers in Hollywood. Like the guys, mainly guys, because I did action movies, there were not a lot of women. Like Lita, I think, was probably the only woman who was writing big movies like that at the time for Cameron. But that sense of people who were very well-versed in storytelling and knew how to hide the wires. You know, they knew how to craft stories where you weren't just watching like the wheels turn, but instead you're kind of like delighted by like, oh, that happened, you know? And it was set up and it's a payoff of a setup, but you didn't see it. That was probably the best part. The worst part is probably it's a business that does not reward loyalty or honesty.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of like trying to get people to do things and manipulating people.
Yeah.
And yeah, you've seen Entourage, you've seen this movie. They're spot on. It is the way the business is. It's not a business where you can trust a lot of people, which is sad.
Do you think the business has changed post-tech growth versus pre-tech growth?
Not really. I say why. There are some businesses where it's a very scalable, like do this, produce this many donuts, market them this way, you will sell this many donuts, right? Open another franchise, your 1,000th franchise, or you know, it's modular.
They're tried and tested models.
Yeah. So the best you can do in film or entertainment that's like that is like, oh, we're doing the sequel or the remake of the thing, right?
Yeah.
But very similar, if you actually map like how film is made and how startups are made, if you were to take the same conversation from the film world, replace like studio with venture capital firm, replace independent financier with an angel, right? And you go through these things, you're basically trying to do the same thing, which is like, hey, can we with a small group of people make this product that right out of the gate is going to have this huge return, have mass commercial appeal, a scale like Instagram did or TikTok, you know, or whatever, or, you know, OpenAI, and bet a ton of money on exactly that scale, right? And the reality is no one knows.
Yeah.
So it means that the businesses are run by fear. Because you just don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard to model that. And you can always look in hindsight and go like, you know, in January, movies that star redheaded love interests do really well as long as they're in English and they're set in the future. You know, you do that. But then you do make one of those by that formula and next January you have a bomb. Because it wasn't really about the redheaded female. It just happened to be patterns you were trying to find in historical data. It's not predictive.
It's funny you say that. I didn't know this until I read a couple articles and blogs, but TikTok spent over $1 billion or $2 billion in marketing dollars to garner the name and get the brand and become that sensation that it is today.
Yeah.
There's a chance that would have failed.
Yeah.
But they spent $1 billion or $2 billion of marketing spend to make it a household name. And it could have not.
Yeah.
And but
they're doing that now with the shopping. As you know, the merchants on TikTok, that free shopping, TikTok is paying for just to get people over because consumers expect Amazon.
Yeah.
The fees that TikTok is charging the merchants are way reduced right now because they're just like, we have to spend all this money to get people customers TikTok shopping. And it's working.
Yeah. They're garnering sort of a behavior.
Yeah.
And even if 5, 10% of that behavior sticks, it works out in the long run.
It's true.
What's one thing you learned from the film industry that you take with you to tech startups and everything else? What are one or two things that you learned being in film and production? Because those are traditionally non-tech companies. They're more people-first businesses, from my understanding.
That's exactly right.
What learning did you take away from that?
Information is power. And that means both your personal knowledge, personal skill set. Like if you really understand the guts of story, you are valuable at any company. You could be a director, producer, writer, studio executive. Right? So if you have a great personal skill set there, same thing. If you've developed your skill set as a product person, as a developer, as whatever, that's incredibly valuable. So there's that knowledge, information is power of just like, I have it inside me. And then there's also the knowledge of the landscape. If you know what's happening out there, if you spend the time to develop a network of friends you trust and you have access to that, whether you're in film and you're like, oh, I happen to know Warner Brothers is looking for someone to replace so-and-so in this movie, da-da-da. Or whether you're like, oh, I know that, you know, Andreessen just didn't invest in this company, but they're dying to invest in that space. Information's power.
How do you leverage that learning today?
In what I do now, I try to find the people I think have the highest signal to noise ratio. And I try not to waste my time with people that just recite what they've heard. You know, it's not interesting to hear, well, you know, this gossip, that rumor, this thing, whatever. But it's actually people who have some insight into it. You know, that whole thing about like, there's like information, there's data, there's knowledge, and you know, like sort of how you process it, it becomes more valuable.
Yeah.
Like I try to limit my real interactions with people where I'm like, okay, we can trade like valuable information that's maybe processed into knowledge, maybe has experience, sweet wisdom.
Is that a key deciding factor for you when deciding who to work with, who to hire? And do you use it on that side or just in general with
I think any in general, the day-to-day, like with whom I spend my days is very important. If you're talking about hiring, I am a big believer that it's better to hire for a personality type than for a skill set. Like if I need an engineer, whether it's a co-founder, whether on my team, whatever, and there's like the guy or girl who is just amazing at it, but is sort of shifty. The last five jobs has spent like under 2 years in each of the jobs, hops around, da, da, da. Or there's someone who's like hungry, hasn't. Maybe he's not trained on React or state machines, whatever the hell it is you need, but it's just like hungry and smart and loyal. Every day of the week, go that person and develop them. Be like, how can I help you learn the things you need to learn? Because that's culture. Culture is saying, I care more about the people who are working here than the skill set. Because you hire for the skill set, you're basically messaging everyone going, I don't care what kind of person you are. Backstab each other, do whatever. As long as you're a really good React.
Yeah. And I 100% agree with that because I feel like, especially when you talk about engineering, product, I still think there's a sense of intuition that is needed to be like a good product person.
Yeah.
I think engineering, if you're a good problem solver, I don't think it should matter whether you're a React pro or a Java pro or a Python pro. You can learn. I think the only place that makes a difference is when you're talking about super seniority and being able to write a truly scalable, like perfect low latency. Like there's all these things.
Yeah.
Maybe in that case, I may prefer a slightly more skill set heavy. But in most cases, unless you're like a Facebook or a Google, like does that top 2% core skill in that experience in that skill matter? Probably not to my understanding, but
I would add to what you say in this way, which is, suppose you have a piece of code that you know, today we need to be able to serve 10,000 concurrent users, right? But man, if we do our job right, we're going to need to serve 1 million concurrent users.
Yeah.
I would rather have the girl or the guy working for me who wrote the 10,000 version and go and seek out someone as an advisor or contractor and go, oh, dude, you wrote the Facebook backend when it went from 10,000 to a million. Can you come over here and teach Emily or Abby or whomever? Da, da, da. And I want them to grow that skill set because I believe in who they are, rather than try and find that other guy and be like, you know, I know he's kind of a dick, but we needed someone who knew how to scale the backend.
You know the company AppSumo?
Yeah.
So
that was one of our coaches.
Oh, nice. I was listening to a podcast of his the other day, and he said every like senior leadership or someone in some position in his company has an advisor. Mm-hmm. And they have an advisor who you pay $500,000 or whatever their rate is, because they provide immense value, like you're saying, to whoever he has within his organization to help them grow. Yeah. And I think that's something a lot of people underlook, and they try to hire the best person for the job, which is probably not always the right decision, but that makes sense. Going back to your journey, why did you go from film and production to working back in tech, chief strategy officer at various companies?
You know what?
What was that transition?
Yeah, that transition was a painful one, where I was at Fox, and the only movies that were on my, you know, sort of slate that my boss was really excited about were sequels. And there's one in particular where the script was not good, but there was a star who wanted this to go and get his paycheck, blah, blah. And it's basically like on greased skids to be made. And there were other projects that were incredibly thoughtful and well-written, blah, blah, blah. It was like, no, this is going to get the spring, you know, release slot. And it was a moment of reckoning for me where I was like, I'm not going to wake up, be like, you know, 45, 50 years old, telling my kids, you know, guess what I did? I made this, you know, number five of this sequel. And man, that sense of like, how do you want to spend the days of your life? Like, am I going to give another year of my life up to do this thing? Because, hey, man, I've got a go movie. Like, my boss, the chairman of the studio, is like, budget it, board it. Like, let's get this thing going. Hire some co-stars. And I was like, no. I want to do something, again, that entrepreneurial thing. Like, I want to have some agency. I want to be able to say, this is what I believe. And I've had some failures since, had a couple times. It's just like, oh, man, we tried really hard. That didn't work out the way we wanted to. But I know that I tried as hard as I could. At the end of an experience, whether successful or positive, I always write down to myself, what is it? Let's capture right now. What is it I learned, right? Because it's easy for that to fade in the weeks and the months post. And those were incredibly rewarding. Even the painful ones where it's like, I wish this turned out differently. Well, in hindsight, man, they were instructive. So that for me is a big thing. I'm just like, I could stay at the studio. I have friends that work on Ant-Man 7 and they have scripted stuff for 4 or 5 years from now. They're like, dude, we're making Ant-Man 3 or whatever they're making now. We have scripts done for years. We'll just keep cranking them out. And it's a great paycheck, but you wake up and you're like, man, there aren't my 40s. I made some great sequels.
Talking about some of the companies that didn't work out, what in the journey made you say, hey, this is not working. I got to figure out the next move, call it quits or whatever. And how do you make that decision? Because I feel like for people listening, if you're working on your first company or your second company, it's hard to be like, should I still keep this going, right? Mm-hmm. And it's hard to make that decision because there's a lot of personality or like emotion tied to that business and venture. How do you make that decision? What are the signs you see? What are some of the signals?
I would tell you this. When I was in film, I was very lucky. As an executive, you get to meet pretty much anyone. Like when you're a senior executive at one of the 6-7 studios, you can kind of call up the vice president of the United States, be like, hey, we're thinking about doing a movie about the White House. Love to come to DC and meet you. You can kind of meet anyone. So it's awesome in that regard, right? So you get a great overview of people. And something I noticed in Hollywood was that the common factor of a lot of the ones that were working, writers, actors, directors, da, da, you want it to be talent, but it is not. It is perseverance. The ability to take no in stride and move forward, that was the common factor that people I knew. It's like, man, they just keep making movies. They keep making TV shows, right? That thing.
Like they're outcome independent.
Yeah. And sometimes it's a pathological thing where they just don't hear no. They're just crazed and in it, but they just continue forward. And sometimes it's a very thoughtful thing about like, I'm going to hear 10 no's. Like everyone in the Valley talks about all the people who passed on every $1 billion, you know, company, you know, every $1 trillion. Do you know who passed on this? Great. Yes. 4,000 people passed on Joe and Brian when they were pitching Airbnb, right?
Yeah.
So you hear that a lot. And some people are very thoughtful about that, going like, okay, so for every no, what did I learn?
Yeah.
And the answer to your question about like, when do you know to give up?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I definitely have seen perseverance be, if not the most important personality sort of trait, one of the two.
And so I think the question is not more give up as much as it's, when do you know it's time to pivot or figure out the next stage of whatever the product or company is, right? Because I think folks who are building new companies, new startups, new agencies, mm-hmm. whatever, there are points where like you could be making all the right moves, but you don't have product market fit. You just mm-hmm. haven't found the right problem. But you get so tied to a solution, you get so tied to a market, a situation. Mm-hmm. My first company, I got to make this work. And what are some signs that you look at to start seeing, okay, maybe I need to pivot, maybe I need to figure something out? Like, are there some signs that you commonly see, look out for, that you over the years you've figured out?
I'll tell you what I believe, because there have been times I've followed this advice, and there's sometimes I've turned a blind, deaf ear to my own advice, okay? Which is, it is about talking to your customer. Because investors, they have a lot of variables in why they're investing that are not necessarily your success. It may be a thesis they have about the space. It may be like a lot of things, you know? And your friends obviously are worthless because they love you and they're completely blinded, you know? Yeah. So it really in my mind is just like when you're having those moments of like, should I have more traction? Like, why aren't I finding more traction? Do I pivot? Do I not pivot? Do I stay the course? All this stuff. A lot of it for me is like reaching out, just cold emailing some customers, me like, hey man, can you spare like 10 minutes? I just want to hear your thoughts on what we're doing and try to figure out, like you said, what is their problem? How do they define their problem? Not how do I project my idea of the problem onto them, but like, what is your problem? Oh, it's not actually your arm is broken. It's your foot is broken. Oh, okay. I knew something was broken. So that's really instructive. It's your foot. Got it. You know, and that is where I think you need to go. Okay. I should pivot to handling feet. It's also been an exploration for us with my current company, just continually narrowing in on like, okay, why do you use us? Like, you know, some people, it's like, you've been paying us for 2 years. Tell me, what is the deep reason you do? And that's been fascinating for us because it's not necessarily about productivity as much as it's about the sense of like, this brings us together. Like, together we go further.
Yeah. Makes sense. Adding on to that train of thought, mm-hmm. having been part of various different ventures, yep. what do you look at to validate or decide, okay, hey, I want to start this, right? Whether it's a new venture business, whatever. Are there problem spaces you look at? Is it customer validation, like you said? Or what are some signs you're like, hey, I want to go solve this and here's the thing I'm going to build?
You know what? It all begins with, do I feel it?
Yeah.
Because you're right. You need to do things to validate it in the market. Like, go talk to X number of people and go do market research. What's your TAM, your SAM, your SOM? Like, yeah. There's a lot of things you can do to validate it. But the primary question for me is, am I excited about that? Like, is it something where you go, yeah, I found a very interesting litmus test in my life. Do I wake up before my alarm? And the times I'm working on the right thing and life's going the right direction, I wake up, I turn off my alarm before it goes off and like get to it because I'm like, oh, this will be great. And the days where it's like, my alarm goes off, I'm like, oh, I got to get up. It's when I've been working on the wrong thing. That for me is the fundamental thing of like, is this something that excites me? And then you have to make sure, will it solve a problem for anyone? Or is it just a cute thing I want to make for myself?
So when you say, if this is what excites me, are you talking about a problem space, an idea, a potential solution, the customer base you're going to be working with, or the overall?
That's the thing is, the thing that excites me can be, I have that problem. Yes, my foot hurts too. Let's go figure out splints or, you know, reconstructive surgery. Do whatever. Yeah. And sometimes it is like the elegance of a solution. It can be like any sort of thing that just like catches you go, that's really cool. I'd be excited to work on that. And then of course you need to start validating how many people have the problem, how bad is it? Da, da, da. I'll tell you an interesting thing is a buddy of mine, we were having dinner. He's one of the top IVF guys in the United States. When Laura, you know, my now wife, but at the time, early girlfriend, and I were serious. He was like, wow, okay, Steven's really serious. I want to meet her. Came over for dinner. A lot of it was him sizing her up, like, who's this girl? Yeah. Steven's dating, this sort of thing. It's super fun. And he started talking about epigenetics and some of the recent studies that had been done. And I was intrigued enough. Like, I went home that night and I was like, Emory University, Hunger Winter, da, da, da. And like this little tidbits he dropped, researched them. And then later he and I were having a conversation, you know, separately over dinner. And we talked to epigenetics some more. I was like, hey, dude, I read all about that stuff you brought up. That's incredibly cool. And that explains a lot of stuff that we haven't really explained with normal genetics. You know, Mendel and Darwin, you know, they were right about a lot of stuff, but this layers on top of that. And that was the kind of thing where, yeah, there was not a problem I was solving at first. It was the notion of like, that's super interesting. Okay, what is that? Now, with that conversation with Johnny, he's like, well, I work in like female reproductive health. This actually is really about like sperm, like DNA and sperm and like male reproductive health and also male factor infertility. That's the problem we need to solve. And it happened to be, for anyone who doesn't know this, male factor infertility and fertility in general is a huge problem that not enough people are talking about.
Yeah.
It's a thing. And it was very interesting to start that company.
So you went from film, various startups, various roles, mm-hmm. and now you started Centered, mm-hmm. right? Why don't you talk me through just how did that come about, co-founding team, whatever, like how, what was that journey for Centered?
You know what is interesting about that is this concept of, let's call it the genre of apps that are called productivity apps or stuff like that. There have been a number that I've used. Going back to like, I loved Clear. I thought its UI was so cool, you know, and Wunderlist and these sort of things. And then having it work to use stuff like Asana and Linear and, you know, Jira and stuff like that, right? So there's the whole spectrum of like super fun UI or like super staid, boring UI, but functional for huge teams, right? Yeah. And I hated that stuff. I was just like, I've never actually used one where I felt delighted to use it. There was some, a couple of moments, I think, with Wunderlist and Clear. It was like, oh, that's a really delightful UI. Like when you first saw Tinder and the swiping and you're like, you guys did a cool thing there. Like that works beautifully under your thumb, right? Even if you're not looking for a dating app, which I wasn't. I remember having dinner, I think it was with Sean, one of the other guys at this group dinner, and he showed it and it was like, nice.
Yeah.
Clever. And so that was a thing with like productivity apps. It was not so much, how do we make that? It was more, what could we do that hasn't been done that might be helpful? And the notion of flow states, that was for me probably the most interesting part of the spark of that was, what is that hyper-concentrated place you can go to where you do look up and you're like, wow, 2 hours went by. I finished, got a lot of stuff. I didn't go to the bathroom. I didn't grab water. I didn't get distracted. I didn't pick up my phone. Did I kind of was in it, right? And then learning, obviously, the research has been done on this where it's like, oh, I have a very dilettantish understanding of this. Guys have written books and research papers and all this on that. Well, how can we take the constituent parts, like sort of the components that will help you get into flow and put it behind one button? I'm too lazy. And I think everyone's kind of lazy where it's just like, I don't really want to go into my system settings and put it in focus mode and then go turn on my Spotify and find my playlist. And then I find my Pomodoro timer and turn that on. Go do this thing. And then I'll get my task list integration. To, you know what I mean? Like, you're kind of like, okay, I'm ready to work. I just want one button that goes boom, all done. You're in. And you just like fall into flow. That is the most interesting part. And I think the biggest evolution for us has been, okay, if that's kind of like the core single user game, the thing that makes it interesting is when it's a multiplayer game. And you're like, I may be here, but it's almost like study hall or the coffee shop where I look up and like, there's Abby.
It's a group of people in the same vibe, same same goal.
You know, and you're not chatting, you're not in study hall chatting with all your friends in college. You're not in the coffee shop, like interrupting people, but you look up, you're like, these are my people. Like we're all pulling, we're trying to do something with our lives together. That is cool to me.
So you decide to start this. Is it you, co-founders, just alone? What is that?
A lot of people have come through the company. In Centered, we had several designers, head of design come through, number of engineers. Some of them are still working with us. They're just amazing. Community managers, you know, content creator. We had a lot of people. It was definitely probably 2-ish years of like hunting around to figure out like what is the core of this. Then what it settled into, and when I basically like set up Suka to say, the core of what we do is we give you this community. Inside the community, there's a tool set of productivity tools you can have, right? not that different than if you used FocusMate plus Pomodoro Timer, your TickTick plus Spotify plus Brain FM plus, and you know, like you could stitch this all together. But it's not actually, I think, what makes us magical. Is this transition to Suka was really about, okay, we need to be very lean because obviously there's not a funding round happening right now, right? And then it's about this communal experience and who's really in on that. And that's been cool, like putting together that team, including my co-founder, Michael Cash. He's one of those people that you meet. It's just like, I'll figure it out. If someone else can figure this out, yes, I can figure it out. We need to paint something. I'll figure out how to paint. We need to build a wall. Figure out how to build a wall. Oh, figured do architecture. Okay, well, let's look at other buildings, figure out how they're built. And he's insane. His rate of learning is like amazing and humble. It's just like every day. We chat all day long. It's great.
So to talk about the journey, you start this. How long before you have an MVP out in market? How long does that take?
Pretty quick. But the thing is, our first MVP was not really representative of what we do now.
Okay.
You know, it is that thing of like, every CS student builds like their to-do list app. And it's like, look, my to-do list app, you could like drag and drop it to reorganize. You know what I mean? Like, it's that thing of looking back and you go, okay, so that was cool. There's like a structure of the atomic unit, if you will, of what you're doing is a task, right? You need to get that done. But I think what's interesting is what we're building right now is much more that community, this set of features that give you a sense of like, these are my people. For me, it was very much like study hall in college. That's a model for me of like, I remember going there, being in Doheny Library at USC. And you went there during finals and like, they were all your friends, but it was all quiet. It's just long tables. Everyone would be like, ah, I have a fucking chem final and I gotta do this, you know? And, but you're in it together. And then more recently, when I was in film, like it was the coffee shops where it was just, dude, all these screenwriters, just like it produced screenwriters where you're like, that guy wrote Avengers, you know? And he's drinking the same latte, whatever. I don't drink coffee, but, you know, the same stupid latte, whatever, is the guy over here who was like, I just got to town. I just bought Final Draft or whatever. And I'm writing my first screenplay. And you're all just there, like trying to do something great. That's cool.
How many pivots from when you started Centered to what you have now?
Hard to count because, again, it's that thing of like originally it was very kind of a bare bones like, hey, here are your tasks and like here's how you get them done. And what we're working on right now is probably the biggest pivot, which has been this sense of like, how can you enter this place like a coffee shop? You know what I mean? Sense. So it's totally cool. It's like we've always had notebooks and they're good to write in. But when you go from notebook to actually it's a coffee shop where it's like everybody has their notebooks. That's the thing we're trying to get right now. Like we have some proofs of concept in there. Probably by the time this comes out, it'll be in release.
Nice.
But that's probably the biggest thing of going from like, hey, it's a to-do list in your notebook to it's a place you and your notebook go to be part of a community, to belong to something.
Makes sense. What happened when going from Center to rebranding as a Suka company? What was that transition? Why the transition? And did you change co-founders, change teams? Or like what was happening in that journey from Center to the
Center? Oh, yeah. Well, like January a year ago, my buddy that I was doing Centered with was like, I don't know what to do here anymore. He had a beautiful daughter who was, I don't know, like one and change at the time. And he's like, I want to go get a real job. I want to go be an engineer at a company. He works at a real estate company. He's a fantastic engineer and a really good guy. And it's just like, I'm tapping out. Like, I don't have religion for this anymore. I don't see, you know, this vision. And that's when I was like, okay, I'll just buy the company. I'll just, here's what we need is these core assets. I will happily buy these. And that's why what we went from was that notion of Centered, where it's like, okay, you need to meditate into this to Suka, which is about happy.
Yeah.
And that's why I call it the happiness company.
I'm guessing this was not like a, I don't know the right word, but there was no animosity or like between you and the founder. It was more, hey, it's just not aligned anymore.
He is a great guy. And I can imagine because I'm going to have my first child in like a year and a half, there's a lot that changes in your life. You know what I mean? When you go from being like, hey, guy who's like can do whatever he wants, stay up until 3 a.m. coding, until it's like, I was up until 3 a.m. with my daughter, but now it's morning. Like a lot changes. So,
and the reason I ask is more to folks listening, when you're building a company and mm-hmm. there are situations like this, and there are probably going to happen where you and the co-founder part ways because of whatever, right? Mission, vision.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even in the most amicable separation, there's still those moments of like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this. Okay, well, we're kind of like already transitioning all the stuff over. Like, did you not sleep well last night? Or do you know, just, oh, no, I guess I do want to do it. You know, like, nothing in life is ever, like, even the most amicable divorce we hear about, it's like, oh, my friend's parents just, like, kind of grew apart. They decided to divorce and found other people. Like, sometimes, honestly, they're like, yeah, I just want her to be happy. And she's like, I want him to be happy. And, like, we weren't happy together. Okay, cool. Even in those, there's still those moments of, like, who gets a sofa?
Yeah.
I love that sofa. I love that sofa, too. You know what I mean? I want you to be happy, but I want the sofa.
What are some things you learn in that process of buying out a co-founder, changing, like making sure all the IP is still with the entity? What are some things that you were unaware of in this process that you had to learn when that was happening?
I sold my first company in my early 20s. I've sold companies before. It's not rocket surgery, as I like to say.
Yeah.
It's just about, you have to be really thorough. You know, you have to sit down and go, oh, okay, so as part of our divorce, you know, you get the sofa, but I want the coffee table.
Yeah.
Oh, well, do you think the coffee table and sofa belong together? Yeah, okay. That's a pretty fair point. Okay, so why don't you take the coffee table and the sofa, because they do look good together, then I'll take the living room set. You know what I mean?
Like, makes sense, yeah.
It's like being really exhaustive. So when you empty the house, it's not like, oh, we never talked about the bed and it's sitting in the middle of the bedroom. Who wants the bed, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, in this case, it's like, you know how many, even like vendors you have to run an app like this, it's like, have we thought about whose name Vercel is in and the Git repo and all the Amazon accounts and the Fire and the, you know, Google Firebase? You end up like 60 or 70 things that have to be transitioned. That's probably like the biggest pain. I don't know if it's a learning thing, because it's just like, just do it thoroughly, as you kind of know the first time you sell something. But it is one of like thinking through every little dependency and just like the post office mailing account is in whose name. We should probably transition that. Do you want it? I'll take it. You want it?
When I was at Indeed had acquired a company and my team was working on that product, but the domain was still owned in the
stuff like that. Yeah.
So I had to transfer that over.
Yeah.
Then there was a random S3 bucket that had a license and a passport for the old founder. And then it was throwing security errors on the new property and one of Indeed's team flagged it. But like random stuff like that, you don't think about it. Recently, the original founders of the company, the domain was in their name and it expired.
Yep.
And so like our site went down.
Yeah.
Like, okay, no bueno. Set up a temp site, but then GoDaddy wasn't letting us renew it.
Yeah.
And so it took 24, 36 hours to renew.
Yeah.
And then you gotta, in the meantime, you set up a new domain, but then you gotta go back and set up the old one. And now it's like,
you're tap dancing.
And,
yeah.
Like, stuff like that, right? People don't talk about like, hey, who owns the domain? Who owns this? Who owns that? Maybe someone originally bought the domain and the company's been using it. And so like, should the company buy it from them? Like, is it, like,
how much does Adam Newman want for that name?
Yeah. I was just thinking about how.
I know. But let me answer your question, because most recently, the guy my friend did Centered with, like, he's a good guy and he wants to do good things in the world. He wants to have a child and all this, right? So that's probably not the most interesting story for you.
Yeah.
Because the interesting stories, the ones where it's like you don't get along.
Yeah.
And I had one of those. And out of respect to this individual, another guy, I'm not going to name names, but I'll tell you, when we started the company, because it was his idea, he was like, what about this? Da, da, da. And I was like, well, not that, but this related thing I would do. And he's like, okay, let's do that. But it was very close to the first.
Yeah.
We started that. And then during the pandemic, when the world shut down and no one could shop out in stores and da, 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 it was impacted, let's say.
Yeah.
He and I had never had the conversation about, what if this doesn't work? How do we want to wrap it up? And when it came time to go, this is not working, we need to wrap it up. That was a painful mistake on my part of not having gone into it. Just like a chess game. It's just like, I need to think through all the different chess moves, like several moves down. And that was one where I was like, yeah, I mean, simple stuff. Like, dude, we got to pay the taxes. Like, you can't pay yourself out of the bank account and not pay the payroll taxes. I can't believe we're talking about this, but we were. That sort of thing should have been discussed going in, going, hey, man, you know what? Suppose there's a pandemic and everything changes and the world ends, right? How are we going to handle payroll taxes? You know? But You live and learn.
The place where I personally battle with these kinds of things is when you're starting out a company, getting product market fit, getting the right idea, making sure it works, I feel is a lot more important than legality. But I also understand the place of the legality because shit like this happens where you got to handle it. But then every time I'm working with like first-time founders and helping them build their MVP and everything, my push is always, hey, you got everything set up. You have a good MVP. You have a solid product. Why don't you go focus on getting your customer? Because you're going to have to pivot. I don't think your time is best spent in an investor deck right now and making people sign IP agreements and ideas.
Right.
Like, I understand where those have a place.
Yes.
But so many people are so tied to an idea. I'm like, ideas are dime a dozen.
Yeah.
Like, sweat equity matters.
Your idea is not going to work. You will pivot.
Yeah. And I don't know what the right thing to say in this situation is, because you get into these situations where there's conflict, right? And if there is, you didn't plan for it because you were focused on building the company and the app. And 2 years later, you're still doing that, but you didn't do these small things you're supposed to. And so I feel like it's always a battle of like, where is your time best spent? But I mean, once you've done it once or twice, you know enough to like not mess it up for yourself. But again, would you rather spend 10 hours a week figuring out all these agreements?
Right.
Or would you rather spend eight of those hours talking to customers, right? I know where I would right now, but I'll be burned once and then I'll be like, no, let me go spend the 10 hours.
It could be, but I'll pick up on something you said, which is it is a very early signal about the NDA.
Yeah.
Because yes, there are absolutely sometimes an NDA is really important. Hey man, I own a $10 billion chip manufacturing. We came up with a process to make 0.001 micron, you know, printed chips using potatoes and peanut butter, right? Yeah, you probably gave me a sign of NDA.
And I think that's where people end up thinking their idea is the only best
idea. And that's most of these ideas, you don't need an NDA. You're like, dude, I could take your idea, plaster on the wall of the coffee shop, and it's not going to work the way we plaster on the wall.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's going to try it differently. Most of them, almost all of them are going to fail. But you don't know that when you're a first-time founder, you're like, this idea is precious. And you're like, it's not. The customer is precious.
Yeah. A funny thing I always go back to is at Indeed, I probably built 4 or 5 big features. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of my time on that product, all of those were killed or put in a spot on the app where like people weren't really using it. The first one, I was like, why are you killing my feature? Like, don't, like, I was, but then you understand that, hey, the feature is not important.
Yeah.
The business, the product is. And if the product has moved on from the feature, it's moved on. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. And so like after that, I'm like, I'm not tied down to anything, right? Like if I build it today and you decide to kill it tomorrow, that's fine, right?
In film, it's very frequently called killing your babies.
Yeah.
Because you're right. You write this scene, it survived 5 drafts. It's the most amazing scene. But you're right, after 5 drafts, like the rest of the script has moved on. You don't need that scene and you love it to death. And you're like, I got to kill the baby. Like it's just, it doesn't belong in here anymore. And you're like, I'll save it for the sequel.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I was watching the making of Frozen.
Oh, yeah?
And on Disney Plus, it was a while ago.
Yeah.
And every 2 months, I think, or 3 months, they do like a dry run of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's
very common
animated or it's still sketches or whatever. And this one graphic, I don't know, VFX, like whatever, our artist, he had made a 5-minute scene on Olaf. Mm-hmm. And it was like fully done, rendered, lighting, camera, everything. And then after the thing, they're like, we're going to cut this. He spent 4 months, 5 months of his time building this. And he was near completion.
That no one would ever see.
I mean, I get it, but like that designer, you could see he was a little sad, but like the directors were like, hey, it's not hitting in anymore in the story and we want to put this point across, so we're going to switch out this scene. But I'm like, this 5 months of like...
Yes.
And like if it's midway in the process, I still understand, but it was like done. I was like, that kind of sad, but I mean, I get the point.
That practice, which goes back to early animation days of just taking even pencil sketches, just cutting them together, recording a temp track and just... playing it back with black and white sketches, color, and Katzenberg was a huge fan of that. Like the Pixar guys, huge fans of that. They'll have their little director's cabal, like watch it. It does catch a lot of that stuff early. So it's rare you have an entire finished sequence in an animated film, but sometimes you know, a live action film, you do costume, you do script, you do stage, you use everything. You shoot the damn thing. The editor does his first assembly and you're like, man, it's redundant. We just don't need that. We don't need that anymore. The film slows down too much.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, okay, we spent a lot of time on that.
Sweet. Where is Sukkah right now? What are your plans? What are our next steps?
You know what? We are, as you would appreciate, talking to our members and being like, tell us what we do for you and tell us how we can do it better. So at the same time that we are building out the community, the sense of like, you can see each other, you can sit down there and go, this is my work companion every day. We're just continually going like, how can we make this better? So as we do that, you know, we grow slowly. I would love to see we've hit some sort of hockey stick. We have not hit hockey stick growth, but I am looking for that thing where we find like the right people who are like, I love this. And by the way, I have an audience that would love this too.
Nice. You know? Sweet. A couple questions I like to ask every guest. What are three resources that you would recommend to folks who are actively building early in their journey? Resources could be anything that's podcast, book, blog, article, tool, whatever you want.
Yes. Okay. I sure wish that when I was coming up, YouTube existed the way it exists now. Like it's existed for 2 decades. Yeah. You know? But the sense now of like, man, if I could just sit around and learn, especially if it is a hard skill like engineering, something like that, like there's so much good stuff there.
Yeah.
So I love that is available to be like, oh, I need to pick up this skill. So that and some of the code academies,
yeah,
super helpful. Like I wish right now I wish I could dedicate the time being like, let me just learn more React. Let me get really deep inside that or something. Related to that, with some of the LLMs and the transformers now, to be able to very specifically target things that you want to know about. I'm not talking about people who generate content marketing by having ChatGPT write stupid blog posts that they post on LinkedIn. I hate that. And I laugh when people post the comments, this is generated. But the ability to go and almost like ask your weird cousin who's read the whole internet, hey man, what do you think about this? And then have that breadth brought to you in a conversational way. Like that's another amazing tool. And yeah, you're right. There are some podcasts that are.
What are your go-to?
More interesting than others.
Outside of Funds and Founders.
I mean, that's all I listen to. I just watch this all day long on repeat. So I think some of the more health, like biohacky ones are more interesting to me right now because I'm thinking a lot about having a child next year. Laura and I are talking about like how much, you know, should we eat or what things. We watched Blue Zones, you know, the docuseries. We watched You Are What You Eat. We watched a bunch of those where it's like, we should just eat grains quietly in the dark. So that started to watching some of the Tim Ferriss and Huberman and Peter Attia stuff to be like, okay, I'm not sure I'm all the way out there.
But here.
But I did injure my shoulder and I tried peptides and I don't know, my healing was twice the rate that my orthopedic surgeon thought I would be healing. And I don't know if it's my body. I don't know if it's anything I was eating, but that was the one weird thing. I was like, I'm going to gamble on this BPC 157 TB500 combo. And man, I'm back in the gym. I'm going to be in yoga soon. Pretty excited about that.
Nice.
So yeah.
What is your startup stack? So
we are migrating. It's funny you asked that. We are migrating to a simpler stack because I made a mistake in a previous company. My buddy, who is much more the engineer, built a lot of this around state machines.
Okay.
It is a very small pool of engineers you draw from when you're like, hey, we have nested state machines in our platform. Got anything? I'm not your guy or girl. You know, it's just like, no. So that is something that we are removing right now.
Okay.
And moving to a much, much more vanilla stack because let's be honest, what we do in Sukkah is not intensely like cutting edge. It's the effect that should be the magic, not the how do they build an LLM out of toothpicks? You know what I mean? That's not actually what we do. So we are simplifying our stack, getting rid of, you know, state machines, getting rid of Electron. Electron is a great way to get going cross-platform pretty quickly. But man, the number one complaint we get, do you want to guess?
It doesn't work the way it should.
No, it's a resource hog.
It takes up too much.
This is number one complaint is like, hey, my fan turns on. Like, and we're like, dude, we're just streaming music. And like the Electron has a huge amount of overhead, both, you know, CPU, RAM, GPU.
Yeah.
So that is something else. Now that we have the hint of product market fit, like the people who use us don't churn. Our retention is like 97% plus month over month.
Nice.
Like now it's really about getting the word out and taking care of things like in our stack, electrons in there. It was awesome.
Outside of tech, what's your startup stack that you use? Like Notion, Drive, ClickUp, Jira.
Linear for our project tracking.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're at Google Workspace. We do, you know, like usual kind of stuff. Try and keep things relatively simple. We very, very vanilla. I mean, it's a small company. You know, it doesn't take a lot of people to build this. Yeah. So is there a particular app in particular you want to know if we use?
No. Okay, no, cool. Yeah. No, the reason I ask is just some people are pure Google. Some are like Asana, Jira, Notion, Slack.
Linear and Google and Zoom.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Also inexpensive. Straightforward and inexpensive. Nice. Really key word.
Two more questions. Okay. So what is your support system? Someone asked me this recently and I was like, I'm going to steal that. But like outside of your company, your co-founder, in general, what would you say is your support system
Amazing partner. Just love her to death. Talk to her about everything. You know, she's SVP at a regional bank and like has her own sort of life and her own perspective on stuff. So she's not like another startup founder. Yeah. We're just complaining to each other. It's a very different life, right? You'd be better. You know each other. So she's awesome. And yeah, my co-founder is just a great guy. He's the kind of guy, like if I had a daughter, I'd be very happy to her marrying someone like him. Like just a guy you trust and you like.
Nice. Cool. I ask every guest to give me a question for a future guest. So your question from a past guest is...
What did Tim Ferriss ask?
How do you find a co-founder? What's your experience in building a business with one? And do you recommend getting one?
Yes, especially in the startup world, great to have a co-founder because they're going to complement your skill set, complement your emotional sort of like makeup. So like I'm an optimist. I'm continually dreaming. Da, da, da. Michael is my co-founder, very pragmatic, very like down to earth, grounded. So it's great to have that where I almost feel like empowered to be a dreamer and optimistic because I know the conversation with him will not be two crazy dreamers doing stupid shit.
Like you're the visionary versus...
Yeah, and I think he has a vision. It's not to diminish his vision, but he's definitely one who goes like, okay, so if we're going to do that, we got to think about the Twilio cost. Maybe we should look at what Mux is doing, blah, blah, blah. You know, we should probably test this out with a small group of people and see, do they actually want this? You know, like, where I'm like, you know what we should do is we should serve ice cream through their mice. You know? And he's like, they're not using mice and we can't move ice cream across the Ethernet. You know, the internet. Yeah. So definitely have a co-founder. Every co-founder that I've had has been someone I've known for a while. So it's nice to have that like history with them of being like, hey man, we've known each other for a year or two, or in some cases like 10 years.
You know? Nice.
So that is my thought. I've never actually gone like co-founder dating or co-founder hunting, which is a thing. I need to find a technical co-founder. I need to go find a marketing.
Which I recently found out about, that people do 3-month arrangements with proper contracts.
Oh, and yeah.
Like, hey, let's figure out the vibe. Let me pay you a consulting fee your time.
I've never had to do that, but it was a thing. I never had to do that.
Okay.
Does that answer the secret question from past guests?
What's your question for a future guest?
What would you change about the world if you were God? One thing. What's one thing you would change? You're a guy, you go, this.
Okay.
Water's not wet.
Sweet.
On that level, you could change it. And not just like, oh, I'd make the road safer. Yeah, like you could change anything as God.
Do you have an answer for that?
Yeah, but I have to come on again and answer it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet. But yeah, that's all I had for you. Where can listeners find you? What do you want to tell them about? Anything to look out for?
Hello, guys. You can always reach me in the chat of the Sukha. So if you go to thesukha.co. for the Sukha company. Jump in the chat, say hi to people. It's an incredibly supportive community. And I am there pretty much 5, 6, 7 days a week. So if I can help anyone or if anyone wants advice, wants to learn more about flow states, this is why we do this. This is literally so people can be happier. That's why I call it the happiness company.
Sweet. We'll link everything in the description of whatever this comes out in a couple of weeks.
Great.
And I'll keep you posted.
Amazing. But
thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning into Funds and Founders. If you're a local Austin founder, a venture capitalist, or just someone who's building and in the middle of their journey and would like to be featured on an upcoming episode, submit your guest pitch to abhinavsinha.podcast@gmail.com. If you have a founder-specific event you'd like to promote on the podcast, you can also reach out to me. If you want to continue to get support through your founder journey, hit the follow button and I'll see you in the next episode.